libraries in the country. My name is Jeanette Sanger, and I'm a trustee of this wonderful library where George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and all of our founding fathers took their books out. And I'm thrilled you're all here tonight, and I ask all the members to contribute generously, because remember, your membership only covers about a third of the services you get, including wonderful programs like this. And I always try to find some connection between our speaker, subject, and the library. And our wonderful, rich collection did not disappoint me. And Harriet Shapiro helped me find who does all of our exhibition. And it turns out we have valuable and interesting texts on ancient Egypt, including one in our rare book department exhibit here recently. The book is Ancient Egypt by Samuel Binion, profusely illustrated with engravings and colored plates by the best artists, published in 1876. So you may want to come back and look at that. I am so happy to introduce the most brilliant person I know. Don't be insulted, Bob. Susan Bryn Mawr. One night at dinner, I told Susan I wasn't sure how great I thought Catullus was. Well, Susan immediately quoted several quatrains in Latin, in the original Latin, and then wrote out for me your own translation. And it turned out it was quite beautiful, and now I like Catullus. Susan attended Barnard College and Columbia University, where she studied classics, Arabic, and Egyptology. First, she worked as an archaeologist in Egypt in her early 20s, and later traveled extensively alone in the desert of Egypt, Sudan, and Central Africa on a Guggenheim fellowship. Her first book, drawn by this experience, is The Names of Things, A Passage in the Egyptian Desert. Her second, widely praised Wolves and Honey, A Hidden History of the Natural World, used her unique mix of essay, narrative etymology, poetry, and her charming pen and ink drawings. The Dawning Moon of the Mind, Unlocking the Pyramid Text, has gotten fabulous pre-publication reviews. Publishers Weekly said, a brilliant combination of literary criticism, cultural history, and linguistic expertise, a dazzling new translation of the hieroglyphs of the Pyramid of Nubia, as well as a detailed and thoughtful guide to interpreting hieroglyphs and understanding the culture that produced them. The book is incredibly exciting as it comes up with a stunning new interpretation of an ancient system, completely contradicting the accepted translation. Susan, in addition to all of her other accomplishments, has an incredible memory and can recite endless poetry. It is a great treat for me when she recites the whole Walrus and the Carpenter, which I love. And now let us welcome Susan Bryn Mawr.
Questions. transcendent beauty. It is the agent of all transformation. It is the origin of all things. It is so familiar that it is known by all, yet so familiar it is forgotten and unseen. But even forgotten, it is the one essential thing, the dawn. But to go back or forward to the night, Orion rises in the sky, the giant man of light. There is an implicit angle of his rising, a diagonal, a path. In a single night on this path, he will sail across the sky. There are the unmistakable brilliant three stars, and Lam, the string of pearls that are his belt. And beneath the short clustering dimmer line that goes down, Orion's sword, the great Orion Nebula, the green swirling clouds of space. Above Orion on the diagonal is the red star in the root of the horn of Taurus. And below on the diagonal is Sirius, the sapphire star, the brightest star in the sky. Anyone can see them, the jewel-like stars, going around the sky, night after night, year after year, marking with exact geometrical precision, slightly altered each night by moments in time, the geometrical degrees on the horizon that equal them, the progression of the night, of the season, and coming back to its same coordinates, the year. Thus the sky is an elegant clock, turning with visible arms, the dipper swinging around the North Star, marking the deeply and gorgeously integrated life of everything on Earth. If you were in China tomorrow, it would mark the hours in precisely the same way that it does in upstate New York today. For the hours, or I, are stars. This is a geometrical grid that anyone can see. Geometry in the truest sense. It measures the Earth minutely. It has a life of its own. It is not abstract. It is not human. But you can know it. And to know it, to see it, belongs to a deep aesthetic sense that transcends what is human. The wail of the wild dog rises with the moon in the cold night air. There is no need to look to anyone to explain it, this numinous world. The properties that extract us from it and render us back into it, the miracles of conception, birth, and death, are properties belonging to all that exists. Pure energy, the nature of light, underlies all. We emerge from and dissolve back into this radiant ground. Not only can you know this, you are this. Poetry and religion arise from the same source, the perception of the mystery of life. Its brilliance in writing belongs to this universal language. The vehicle at work is associative thinking, in which metaphors act as keys to unlock a primeval human sense of the integrated living world. The meaning may not come across on a pedantic level, but on a poetic level it is transparent. Animal-headed gods, for example, seem alien, indeed ridiculous. When you think of them not as gods, but as signifying the qualities of the animals themselves, they take on a different meaning. They resonate with an innate sense of animal motion, symmetry, force, color. What is alchemy, literally the Egyptian thing? Or, as the American Heritage Dictionary defines it, the Egyptian practice of transmutation. What or where is the gold? One looks to the realm of Egypt to find out. The task is to take a medium that is proverbially indecipherable and to enter it, as though entering a pyramid with a lamp that gradually illuminates what is there. The first step is to look at the words themselves, and then in the second step, through them, as though through an uncovered lens, see what is written on the walls of the hidden book. The third step is to ask what it means, to seek the deeper design that is the key to this primary early religion. Hieroglyphic means mysterious, yet hieroglyphs themselves are instruments of absolute clarity that present a elusive record of the natural world. This is writing as it first was, a mirror of life, eliminating the dimensions of time and place and decay. It was a holy thing, because it worked. So, I was thinking of starting this talk with the line, across the sea, where I have lost a scepter, I hear the name of my dappled nouns, which is Nabokov writing about Russia. He's talking about the life in words, in Which is really what hieroglyphs are like. On the most basic level, these are vivid metaphors drawn from nature. So the flamingo is the hieroglyph for red. The vulture is death. The curlew is the verb to find. The cattle egret, the snowy egret, is the verb to tremble, not because the egret itself trembles, but because it has the long white feathers that tremble in the wind. This acute and subtle level of observation is present even on the letters of letters themselves. So the letter F is Cerastes, the horned viper. And you can actually really see F emerging from this animal, which buries itself in the sand and points to the horns. And if you don't see them, flips up and bites you in the ankle, and you're dead in 5 minutes after excruciating pain. And this is absolutely deadly snake. It is a very common animal in Egypt today. And it makes a sound before it hits you. It makes a sound that sounds like F. And it is the letter F. And so the word for cobra in Arabic in Egypt is af. In Greek, ophis is snake, microbiology, or pupus is snake handler. So this what I'm trying to say is that even on the level of letters, with hieroglyphs, you have this feeling that you're looking at the vividness of nature itself, but through this incredible human intelligence, a sense of aesthetics and humor and wit and heightened awareness. I wrote them 20 years ago. They are prismatic vehicles of hidden deeper shades of thought. You can pull them up at different angles until the light bursts through in an unexpected color. The word carries the living thing concealed across millennia. So I begin this book with a quote, and the quote is, how do we talk about natures? And I used to live on this really broken down old houseboat on the Nile, back in the 80s, called Fustat, and it belonged to the American Research Center, which was actually, it was trying to get rid of it. I lived on this old houseboat in the Nile, and it was New Year's Eve. Was taking Donald Johansson, who's from the institute, who had the Institute for the Study of Man, around Egypt. And he came to Fustat late at night. Johansson went back to his hotel. So Lena and I are sitting around getting drunk around midnight on Fustat on the deck of this old steamer in the middle of Cairo. And Cairo is such a dense city that it is really a pleasure just to be, out on the river. And he was saying to me, well, how do we talk about natures? And what he meant was, a nature is a prayer flag in hieroglyphs. And it was translated in the 19th century as God. And so the idea was that this meant God. And I think they probably didn't know what prayer flags were, but of course now we do know, because they're all across Africa and Asia and India and China and all over Egypt and so on. But anyway, what Mark meant by it is that a netra is mostly used as an adjective, meaning holy. And he was saying, well, this is how we think about words that are drawn directly from nature. And interestingly, when people first saw this word, they thought that it was the origin of the word nature, which is natura. which is what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about hieroglyphs as a language for a few minutes, and then I'm going to actually talk about the pyramid text and just show what's there, show the conventional translation, and then talk about the ideas. But contrary to popular belief, hieroglyphs are not something that need to be deciphered. They're not a cryptic language. They're not even a terribly difficult language. They are a very learnable language. There's a phonetic alphabet with 26, and forgive me if you've already know this, but just because I think there is this idea that hieroglyphs are something that is unreadable. But this is not at all the case. It's a phonetic alphabet with 26 letters, much as our own alphabet. And in this very early stage, there's a lot of variation in spelling, or some variation in spelling, but because the sounds are in the same range, you generally know what you're looking at. And there are languages that are called Proto-Semitic, so they're kind of a language that's on the pattern of Arabic. And so, for example, you would learn, as you do with any language, French or whatever, about 20 to 40 words that are your basic vocabulary. And in hieroglyphs, it's the same, but a lot of words are the words in Arabic today. For example, nefs, breathe, mudadad, akal, food, moya, water. These are basic words in hieroglyphs. This is part of your basic vocabulary. Walk, fall, sarayr, small. These are all hieroglyphic words as well. And I don't think this is much talked about. In hieroglyphs, as in Arabic and Hebrew and Sanskrit, the vowels are not written in. They can be notations. But words are patterned so that, for example, I was thinking four is an Arabic trilittle and means separate. Africa is the same trilittle, but it's the part that separates all. So it's basically pattern. The way that the vowels are patterned around the trilittle is defined what they are. So if that is a I'm just thinking of the ruckus is there with to dance, orchestra. I've never seen it defined, but I'm sure it's the same word. Again, you have the vowels coming at the beginning and the end and changing the pattern of the word to mean something else. And with that, you have an enormous range of the meanings of those basic three consonants. So anyway, so it's that kind of language. Hieroglyphs are unique in that you don't have to know any of that because they have a universal quality, because the word is spelled out and it ends with a picture that gives a sense of what the word means. And pictures are metaphors, so that Emerson said language is fossil poetry. This is really it. So what I'm trying to say with all of this probably unnecessary complexity is that hieroglyphs are a readable language, they're an accessible language. There is a big hieroglyphic dictionary over the New York Public Library so that everything I say can be checked. Go to the library, look it all up. And there is a vast literature of hieroglyphs, the beginning of the novel, poetry, philosophy, and so on. And it really needs, I have to say, as T.S. Eliot said in The Sacred Wood, if this tradition is to survive what we need, are more poets who know Greek. Well, if the tradition of hieroglyphic literary language is to survive, it really needs translators and people to take readers and people to take an interest in it, because it's a very much neglected subject. So what I'm doing in this book is I'm looking at the primary, I would say is the primary religious work in hieroglyphs, and it's also the primary literary work. There are versions, Egyptian civilization is 3,000 years, there are versions and versions spinning off of this throughout that time, but I believe this is the earliest version from 23 BC in the Pyramid of Unas, discovered in 1881. Say, far as all of this goes, and I think it might be worth saying that what Jeanette was saying about memorization, that when I was growing up, I'm sort of part of an earlier time, I think, memorization was a very big thing. I thought my neighbor growing up, I thought he was going to come tonight, I'm not sure he's here. But his grandmother was a student in Moscow during the Russian Revolution. And yet we grew up in a small town in upstate New York. She came as a refugee with nothing to the US. And she would talk, it was a vibrant person, she would just talk about Pushkin. And I was thinking of my mother's case. I was from the Figure Lakes, just south of Lake Ontario. My mother was from the other side of Lake Ontario, from Kingston. And her father had gone to the Royal Military College and was an officer during World War I at the Battle of the Somme. And he killed himself, he was totally shattered by the war. And she was raised by her aunt, who was a poet who lived in a wilderness retreat in Canada. And just that feeling reminded me so much of nature and culture, that feeling for poetry is a heightened awareness of where you are and the reverence for poetry that my mother had. And it wasn't uncommon, I mean, the people at that time had the poetry anthologies, they did beaten up poetry anthologies people would carry around. And the memorization, you know, we were taught as children, I started school in a one-room schoolhouse at the age of four, a teacher in the mid-80s, and we were taught to memorize and recite poetry as we were taught to read, all through my education. And so when I started Latin, you know, at the age of 11, it was the same thing. We would produce all the text, you were memorizing it, and then you looked at the grammar on the side. And that's how these languages were taught. And that is how I came to hieroglyphs. In my mid-teens, we looked first at the text and then at the grammar. And I think because of that, I came to hieroglyphs really as literature. At least one simple text seems to just beautifully, on a compositional level, quite remarkable as novels. And then going on to the poetry. And of course, the novels themselves were poetic because poetry, prose derives from poetry, so the prose has the poetic forms. But I've always thought of hieroglyphs as literature. And then what essentially happened to me in my own life was that I was studying this, I went on to study it in graduate school as well, but I went over to work in Egypt when I was around 20. And I did something else that was very typical of my time, which was that I went native. You know, I was much more interested in the people who were supposed to be working for us, who seemed to know so much more than the, you know, people who had just gone over there. I mean, they really knew the landscape, they knew the land. It's like in The Tempest, what is that? The people who knew everything, were the people who lived, you know, they knew everything. I wanted to know everything. And so what I ended up doing, again, very typical of my time, is I just went out and lived on the road for a couple of years in that part of the world. And in those days, I don't think it's true anymore, but there were these great gatherings, you know, these beautiful Mandarin villages. There were these great gatherings for tafras around poets. There were poets who would come just sing all night. And people just knew, again, huge amount of poetry by heart. There was an epic, Homer, or the Sarah Benny Lau, there's religious, improvisational religious poetry. And so, anyway, so that is essentially that's my background to this entire subject, which is that I'm extremely interested, or more than interested, but my entire orientation toward this is this literature. So, back in the days, when I was a student, I was introduced to this work, which is called the Pyramid Text, and I'm just going to go to this. So this is a verse, one of the first verses that I knew from the Pyramid Text, and I copied it from the wall of the Pyramid of Teddy many years ago, which is right there. Teddy is his son-in-law, and so this is just from an old notebook of mine. But if you look at it, what is it? It's a good reflection, I hope everybody can hear me, it's a good reflection of the actual hieroglyphs on the wall. It's very simple, but it's basically saying, it says, you know, song to the great, it's the wealth, is the word for great, that's female, so it's the great female. emerald turquoise, so emerald turquoise malachite stars and grow green, the teddy grow green. Green is a living green. And what's really so beautiful about it is that, so this is really, so this was how I first came to this this body of literature. I just, there's so much, there's so many layers of meaning just in that short thing. And in the pyramid itself, as you can see in the bottom, these, there are actually, I mean, these are words, but they're sprouting leaves. And the idea is greenness and plant growth as eternal life is really what it is. But so the souls of the dead are precious stones that are so, that are, you know, that are made of light, but are sown in the night, in the darkness, and they're and this idea of greenness and growth in them. And so you would say, this is mystical poetry, like Rumi, this is mystical poetry. And so I was just struck by the beauty of it, and so I really wanted to know more about it. I always just loved it. And so this is another verse from the same period. This is also Teddy, and the important thing about this, actually, it's just from a notebook of mine at the time, but it's basically saying of the king, this is just from the wall of the pyramid, you are born of dust with Orion, you rise with Orion in the eastern sky, the third with you is Sirius, purest of places, you know, who leads you along the fair paths of the sky, through fields of celestial rushes. And so again, it, in a pyramid wall, it has these pictures of greening leaves and plants. And so there is this identification of the dead king with the lion, which is important as we go to look at the pyramid of Unas. So in 2006, 10 years ago, I had a grant to, this is the pyramid of Unas. As you can see, it's completely collapsed on the outside. And it's quite small. It's Saqqara. That's the first pyramid, the step pyramid from it's the earliest pyramid. And what happens is that in the pyramid culture, in the whole pyramid building culture, it's only 300 years or so, 300 or 400 years. It starts at Saqqara, and they're basically working out these geometrical forms. And they don't really, you know, some of them are falling down. They go to Giza and perfect the form, and once the form is perfected, this is 200 years before Unas, they come back to Saqqara, the original place, and there are these pyramids. It's the 5th, 6th dynasty of the Old Kingdom. They build these small pyramids, but the small pyramids have this text in them. And here it is, so they're the first inscribed monument. And so here it is, this is the text on the wall. On the first wall, the important thing to see about it, just in this particular, I don't have a pointer, but what I think I want to show is right here, you see a line across the column, and right here you see it. And so basically, one of the first things you see is that the wall is all broken up into different pieces of writing that are blocked off, like this. And there are five of them, so there are essentially five pieces of writing on this wall. And this is what the entire pyramid, every inch of the pyramid inside is covered with this, these letters, in these columns of letters in Greek, of words, that are blocked off into separate things, which are essentially, which are verses. And that's what they are. However, there's a problem with this at the moment, because these have long been regarded as magic spells. And here, let's see if it comes up. This is the scholarly translation. I want everybody to see this. This is the scholarly translation of this text in Brill, which is the Dutch scholarly publisher. So, it's fun. So it's really true. This is the scholar. This is the accepted scholarly translation of this text. And they're regarded as, these things are often that are obviously verses, have been regarded since the 19th century as magic spells. And you have to ask yourself if something of this complexity of execution, if you just look at it again, possibly be, I mean, I think this is the question, could possibly be this meaningless? And it just goes on and on like that. And there's an enormous edifice of scholarship based on the idea that this is what it's all about, you know, that these are these magic. And as you can see, there's another page about it. So it really is only a side issue. But the point is that this is the moment when we're finally, or at least I'm hoping that what this book is going to do is to open up this subject so that more people in this room, more people will start looking at the actual hieroglyphs and seeing what's there and get beyond this idea, which is essentially the dismissal of not only the entire body of literature, but of a primary religion. Because obviously this is not what it's about. So that's the first question. What is it about? You know, this is the important question. So what is the text really about? So this is the first verse, and I'm just writing out the... I've got everything, it's in very miniature on my computer. But anyway, so the first thing that you see, or the first thing that I noticed as I was sitting down with this graph to do the whole thing, was that the pattern is repetition, and I go through this in detail in the book, but if you look at the first two columns of the text, the words are, it's using the same words with just very subtle variations. So most of these are familiar words, and the reason for the magic spells is that the idea really has to do with this hieroglyph, the prayer flag, which is right here, the holy things. So that's the concept has been that these are gods, and that they're doing something. And so one of the first things I noticed was that. So you have the preposition above, the word for fire, which I marked out there on both sides, the word for fire, the picture that defines the fire, which is a fire drill, the preposition beneath, and then under it this word, achnet, which is just spelled out phonetically in hieroglyphs. Here's the same word in another verse inside, pyramids. Here it is. This is the word high, for slave, it's learned one of the words for snake in Egypt today. So it's saying Brodar, serpent. And this is the hieroglyphic dictionary. And you can see that it is basically the root for darkness. And you can see it's got all these different endings attached to it. But the basic concept is darkness. So what I saw, and I have to say that as I saw it, you know, the hair on the back of my neck started to stand up because I realized as I was looking at this verse, I never quite know how to convey this in talk, but you realize that you're not just looking at words, at something archaic, an ancient history, that you're actually looking at reality, a very vivid portrayal of reality. And so what the verse is actually saying is, above the fire, beneath the holy things, as they grow dark, as the falcon, and it's just a picture of a falcon, the word for falcon in hieroglyphs is care. It's the sound that a falcon makes. I hear it every day. It's the sound that a red hawk makes, or any of these birds. Very common sound. And the name of it is imitated. The sound is imitated in Greek with ke, and these other languages as well. But anyway, so the falcon is care. It's this, and the verb above it is used throughout the Greek text to rise up away from the earth. So as the falcon rises up, beneath the holy ones, as they grow dark, as the falcon rises up, may the dead person rise up into the fire. Beneath the holy ones, as they grow dark, they make a path for, you know, the dead person. And then the next verse is, I mean, at the end of the verse, this is still part of the same verse, is they make a path for the dead person. Takes the path, and these are very simple words. There's not a lot of elaboration. The path becomes a bird. Here it is. It's actually, you can see it's a picture of a path through three trees or bushes above. It becomes a bird. They make a path, it's exactly the same word. It takes the path into it, And then the other thing that that struck me as I was looking at it, and forgive me if this is just too much complexity, but it's just so important because this is how I saw it, is this right here. I don't know if it quite comes across, but this is what you would call, someone was just talking about a hapax legomena. This is something that is only here. And what it is, it's the letter P, the letter I, above the falcon, and beside it is the triangles. And they're all smushed together as one unit. So it identifies the falcon with the triangle. Here's the hieroglyphic triangle, so you can sort of see how it works. And what it is, as you look up at the top in the hieroglyphic dictionary, is that it's the star Sirius is essentially the triangle. So what I realized as I was looking at it was that if that is Sirius, as you can see on this star chart, there it is. There's Sirius, and there is the sort of Orion, and there, right above it, is Taurus. It's a diagonal of rising stars. So if that verse, which has to do with the falcon flying up into the fire, the dead person becoming the falcon flying up into the fire, the falcon is Sirius, then the entire thing about the battle of its penis is actually, it's the sword of Orion. And so I realized that it was a visual, and I'm not being able to quite make sense out of it talking about it, but as you go to the next verse, the next verse is, would the bull break the fingers of the horizon with its horns, come out, rise, that they're actually describing the rising of Taurus. So this is, forgive me if it's a little bit too complicated to just simply explain it this way, because it took me quite a while to work it out. But if this is Sirius, preceded by Orion, and that is Taurus, then the fire is the dawn, the holy ones are stars, and that this is a star map, and that it's indicating a calendar day, which is the rising of Sirius in the dawn. And in Egypt, the rising of Sirius Sirius in the dawn is very significant because the moment Sirius hits there, and Sirius looks like an airplane on the horizon, the moment Sirius hits the horizon in Egypt, the Nile would rise on July 18th until the Aswan, until the dead. Really. So it's the trigger for the rising of the Nile. And the last verse on the wall is the rising of the Nile. So in other words, instead of being a series of nonsensical magic spells, I realized right away that this was something that was indicating, first of all, the rising of Sirius, and it was a star map. And then as you get into this wall, what happens is you come to the last verse, and it's the rising of the Nile. So I'm just trying to think, as I thought, it's something like me who spends a lot of time looking at this. It's a little bit hard to convey it, but and so I should probably stop for a minute and say, am I being clear at all? Is this making any sense? So in other words, so we've got the king being identified with Sirius as he was identified with Orion and the other pyramid, right, the Sirius rising, the Nile rising, but the really interesting thing about it, I'm skipping through these other things. Is that, and I just, because Bob Thurman is here, I just want to say that the rising of the Nile, that verse, the verse of the rising of the Nile, the dead king is identified with the Naga concept. And so as we get to the East Wall, I'm afraid I'm getting much more complicated, and I really spent all out in the poetry. So I should just stop and say, are there any questions that I'm afraid I'm into incomprehensible.
Where did they get the word baboon from?
So the word baboon is the word bebe in the text.
That's what you need.
And they thought that it was baboon because it sounds like baboon, but actually it is the water bird concept, which is here. You see the ba, it is, I don't think I have it out here, but the ba is the soul concept, and it's just the doubling of the ba word, and so they just missed the fact that it was a raya, thinking that it was, you know, just a magic spell in the baboon. But what I've been trying, what I was trying to get at in it was that, this slide is on its side, but that as you get into the text, and what happens is on this first wall, you're seeing these astronomical coordinates, you're seeing these descriptions of key celestial phenomena, which is Orion, Sirius, the full moon, the North Star, the rising of the Nile. On the second wall, the first verse is saying, and this is the verse that we looked at when I was visiting you, here it is, but it's not, it's on its side, it's a slide, but it is saying, he absorbs his seven serpents that manifest at his seven vertebrae. And then you realize that you're looking at this familiar system. And I just, I think I should probably talk about the overall significance of it, because what happens is, as the serpent rises up, generating tremendous heat in the body, and this is what's being described in the text, it becomes, in the overall text, what's happening is that the king is being, the idea is that the king is being seen in these astronomical but that what's actually the other part of what's being described is that the serpent is rising through the body. I just have to stop because I'm seeing I've got a tremendous complexity and I'm losing my thread. But it's told on it's two different things, and I've sort of done it in the book, so maybe that probably best shows the difference. It's just to read. So the sword of Orion opens the doors of the sky. Before the doors close, the gate of the path, over the fire, beneath the holy ones as they grow dark. As a falcon flies, may Unas rise into this fire, beneath the holy ones as they grow dark. They make a path for Unas. Unas takes the path. Unas becomes the falcon star, Sirius. Say the words, would the bull break the fingers of the horizon of earth with its horns? Come out, rise. Say the words, Unas becomes the baboon of the desert hills of old. The rising light is Unas, the wise face is Unas. The shining one is Unas, the face, the head is Unas, the eye is Unas. Rejoice that he remain among you on the path. So that's the moon. O star that sits shining, does Unas not give you his life force, that he remain ever after as a holy thing, that in the axis of the wheel, Unas may float to the sky. Say the words, Unas comes today before the rising, swirling flood. Unas becomes the crocodile, green, as the green is itself in the crocodile. Floating up, face watching, chest raised, he rushes out, rising as a leg and great tail within the shining light. He goes to his banks of silt in the great swirling flood, to the still place in the reeds on the rim of the sky. He greens the green reeds on the banks of the sky. He brings his precious green to the great eye in the heart of the reeds. He takes his place on the luminous rim of the sky. Unas rises as the crocodile, son of the water. Unas eats with its mouth, urinates, copulates with its penis. Venus becomes the life-giving water of semen itself, seizing women in their husbands' arms wherever love arises, according to its nature. And then on the next roll, it begins, and this is what I was trying to show. Venus becomes the primary serpentine life force that absorbs the seven serpents, that manifests as the seven yoke attributes at his seven knots. 9 times 3 sanctified attributes obey these words. Venus comes back as he absorbs myrrh, he receives myrrh, he is blessed with myrrh, he is brought back with myrrh. Venus takes on your power sanctified attributes. As he turns, he yokes your spiritual faculties. Venus becomes the shining, burning, bull-like life force. The brilliant light is the essence of his eye. His mouth is stable in the heat. The head of Venus has the horn of the Lord of the South, the falcon of old. He reveals the path as the holy falcon. He is the root of the azure field of flax. As the flowering twig lifts up, it is Venus who binds the winding growth of the acacia branch to the sky. Venus is the power throughout the earth, north and south. Holy is the night. Venus rises as the three powerful ones. They are Oriah, Venus is Bebe. Venus becomes the son of she who did not know that she gave birth. Venus whose face is full all three nights. Great art thou, golden one, hidden from people before. Venus becomes Bebe, the lord of the night, who lives although he does not know it. So, on the north wall, you once again have these astronomical coordinates. It starts talking about the dippers in this beautiful verse. Great night uncovers her arms. 100,000 souls, while the head of the sun sleeps below, she weeps these tears. And it goes through these different astronomical features, like the Milky Way, which is being compared to the spine. And this is the whole point. The Milky Way is being compared to the spine. And the ladder to heaven. Mm. So I guess the reason, one of the reasons why I was getting absolutely lost is because it's extremely difficult to talk about what the essential thing that the text is about, which has to do with this rising of the snake through the body, becoming the eye, and that these are actually metaphors, and this is what I was trying to talk about. But that the word tantra is a hieroglyphic phrase in the text. I mean, tantra is earth, and nature is this nature of purify that I was talking about. It's the holy earth or the pure land. And that as you go through the text, which has been understood to be magic spells about snakes, what's actually happening is that if you just go and read through the verses and the verses and verses, the snake is rising up through the body to the head, generating the seed, becoming the eye, and then the eye is going out. And as the eye goes out, that's how the falcon concept comes in. It's actually flying out into the sky. And it's extremely detailed. So that's what my impression is, that this is what the text is about. And so I'm afraid I'm just not really quite able to talk about it, because I haven't done it before. But this is why the book is spelled out in great detail about it. But for example, as you go through the text, you come to places where there are just where it's describing the rising of the eternal serpent. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. So before I say any more about that, I think I should take questions and then answer them.
Well, I think you've done a great job of explaining to us and making the hieroglyphs come alive. It's incredibly beautiful. You've done this very radical, new translation of a revered ancient text. There's going to be a lot of controversy about this. Old men who've been studying this text, you know, being angry with you for this new
the snake is a metaphor. It's a metaphor for energy in the body. The word for snake and the word for life are the same. This will apply. It's the same word. And so you're talking about manipulating energy channels in the body. Now, this whole part of the text that has been about the manipulation of the snake has been understood to be magic spells against snakes. You know, so that's most of the text.
Susan, why did the previous scholars get it so wrong? Were lacking in a appreciation of poetry? What's the deal?
Yeah, I think that's a large part of it. I think that is part of it, because the verses were, you know, again, thought of as spells instead of just seeing them as verses talking about.
You didn't start from scratch. I mean, what's the genesis of what went wrong? And then, was there no one else who even thought about this?
Apparently not. No, this is really the accepted. What I showed you is the accepted translation that's been around for 100 years. But this was a recent version of it, published in 2005. But
when I'm hearing about snakes, I'm thinking of the Garden of Eden. Is there some kind of connection between religion?
Well, I think so, because one of the poetic metaphors throughout the text is your snake encircles you in your tree. And the idea is that the eye is the fruit, the eye is sweet, and the eye is the attainment. And so you have this idea of the snake rising through the tree of the body, and the fruit being, you know, omniscience, essentially seeing the eye. And then there's this whole part about the snake being both the male and the female sides to it. And then, of course, there's a whole part about the two truths, which are, you know, the ma'ati, the two truths, which are form and formlessness. A great deal about things coming, you know, into form and going out of form. A lot of questions about what birth actually is, meaning to say manifestation in the physical world.
The thing that strikes me about this is the old translation, which was spells, did it deal with the economy?
Well, it didn't. And this is what's so interesting. I got in touch a professor at Caltech, Jed Bookwell, has been in touch with me, and he's written three books about this, actually, about how the French, when they went to Egypt with Napoleon, found these great astronomical records in the temples. They were literally dynamiting them out, trying to get them back to France, and they understood that they were incredibly sophisticated, and that they were indicating calendar dates, but that they were zodiacal, and so on. And they really saw that Egyptian civilization was very sophisticated scientifically, mathematically, in terms of astronomy. And Dupuy, of course, before the French, around the time of the French Revolution, published this incredible work saying that all religion derives from Egypt and that Egyptian astronomy is the basis for all religions. For example, when I was seeing this whole thing about the fire, the dawn is the fire, and then in the second verse, Acheron is the horizon, if you break in the Greek Acheron. Thinking, my God, is the whole idea of hell really this fire that is the dawn and the monsters of hell, these poetic descriptions of constellations? Because even the Europeans thought that the bull was a monster. And as you go through the translations of the text, all these things that are obviously references to constellations are seen as monsters. And that's how they've been portrayed. So the question is, is this indeed the idea of hell? Is this the idea of heaven? Then you have this beautiful concept of the field of rushes, which are the eastern stars of dawn. And Moses, of course, is a word in the text, and Moses is the hieroglyphic word for infant. And S is the word to give birth, and this is the noun that comes as infant coming from that verb. And Moses is in the field of rushes, which is to say, he said, it's the soul, the infant soul, as a star rising, the bright star in the east, rising in the field of rushes, which is this beautiful moment. I mean, this is what the whole Egyptian religion, their idea of the dawn, the turquoise blue light before the dawn, that's the duon, and that's where the soul goes to purify. And the letters of this text in this pyramid are that color of turquoise blue. And so you have these ideas. And so in terms of the Garden of Eden, the snake encircles you in the tree. wall in sarcophagus chamber, this great female servant of spiritual power is rising through the body, through love, you know, and so there's that. So you have two truths, you have omniscience, and then you have all of these familiar images that we have. And then of course the whole Osiris idea, you know, Osiris is a Greek word for sort of like a character, but in hieroglyphs it's a rebus, and it's basically a figure. But one of the things, before I get to Osiris, one of the things I wanted to show, and I'm not quite sure if you can see it, but that the ox, well, so here you have this whole thing about the spine. This word here in the middle is imak. It means holy, revered, shining. And what it is, it's the spinal cord. Here's the picture of the spinal cord. And it's known to be the spinal cord with ribs. And Osiris is sort of the spine, the jet column, the spine, so on. And the ox sign, as you can see it here, it occurred to me as I was reading it, my God, it's the cavity of the spine from above with the head off is really what it is. And if you look at the Arabic word for neck, I'm talking about, there's all this Arabic vocabulary in hieroglyphs, the word for neck in Arabic is om. I mean, it is. That's the word, om is the word for neck in Arabic. And so that's what I think it is. I think the whole idea is that, you know, I was talking about electricity being a mystery before Thomas Edison. I mean, it's the idea of the electricity in the body, the energy currents in the body, and being able to, you know, manipulate them in the tantric sense for these transcendent states. Because this is, I mean, tantra is a system that is really much studied now, and we have the great American scholar, I would say, in the front row. So I'm not the person to talk about it. I don't really know very much, but I think it's unmissable here that you're talking about the snake, the eye, the falcon. What they're describing is an experiential reality, and that this and so it is. So I think that's the you know, in terms of the government
imagery.
This
isn't our time. It's pretty much.
Well, you could take
one.
I'm sorry, I spent all that
time,
got lost in the
hieroglyphs,
which
happens.
Could take one more.
Yeah. Isn't the ankh sign a sandal strap?
Well, this is the thing. They say it's a sandal strap, but I say you be the judge. I mean, do you think it is something like a sandal strap that doesn't have this dimension?
Well, if you go to the Met and look down at a statue like the one in the foyer, you can see that it is pretty much the outline of
that. Well, it could be, but another thing about this hieroglyph here in this text is that, as you can see on the line across the middle, it's a composite. This is another hieroglyph that's going straight across, and it's the chest hieroglyph, and it's the hieroglyph for the vertebra, and it means to fasten something on, and it also means, as a noun, it's the vertebra. And so that really is another thing that sort of keys you into the fact that this may well be the case. I mean, all of these things, frankly.
Maybe they're just saving space.
All these things, when you go to the Met and you look at these things, the point is that all of these things are questions. Mm-hmm. You don't know. But I could say to this audience, I mean, how likely is it that something that is as profound as the word for life, could this really be a saddle strap? And I think you really put your point, your finger on it, because before Alan Gardner, before the entire European look at hieroglyphs, because this is what Buchwald was showing, this professor at Caltech, is showing me that the dumbing down of hieroglyphs was a political thing that happened in the early 19th century, really. And it was a response to the rise of the religious right after the French Revolution. He's just all over this. He's written three books about it, that they saw the sophistication and that was thrown out. Yes.
I kept saying that I hesitate to tread in the area of ancient intelligence, but I think you really have made a great contribution in A, resurrecting the sophistication of it. And then B, it does sound, it has resonance with the descriptions of the death process, which is mobilized in Tantra and In this case, though, I think presenting the death of the king as a burst of an increase of life, in a way, merging with the what you pointed out, the constellations and the zodiac and so on. So, and then the life force of the king sort of coming back and rejuvenating the society, you know, that there will be another one. So it's it definitely seems to be turning the misfortune of death, in this case of the king, into a blessing, and predicting a kind of return. I'm just getting that impression from what you're saying, and it seems persuasive to go in the right direction.
Now everyone wants to go out and buy the book, I'm sure, after that.